It's probably not unreasonable to say that over the past year, Perspective has delivered a fair proportion of political angst and reflected the increasing polarisation of political debate. As it's Christmas and we reflect on Christian messages of hope and peace, I thought for the last Perspective of 2025 we should give you a more positive and encouraging programme. Michael Manning, the 8th Manx Bard, has recently published a collection of his poetry titled Gry. Normally we tackle high politics and various other wonderful things on this programme. Occasionally, though, you could argue that politics, the whole political discourse, has become quite a negative and miserable sort of a place, and very polarised. But certainly through your poetry, and one of the reasons you're here is because you have a book of poems out, your poetry does have a habit of inspiring people, and it's possibly looking for some positives as well as identifying some past wrongs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's we live in such a kind of a despairing culture, really, I think. And the public discourse and the public square, if you like, seems to be characterised by voices of anger and hatred and discord and despair in lots of various ways. And I just think that doesn't do anybody any good, really. I mean, I'm all for recognising, we need to recognise the problems that are there and the problems that are in front of us. But that we shouldn't be paralysed by fear, and we should have a, you know, I think people are thirsty. I'm certainly thirsty for a more hopeful vision of what the world could be. And I know lots of people who are just lovely, you know, and the world can be a better place, and let's get on and make it that.
And even people who can say quite nasty things on social media are generally quite nice people, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my one of the joys of spending lots of time down at the drop-in that Gry used to run, welcoming the homeless guys, was, you know, people who would often look and often act quite aggressively. As soon as you got to know them, as soon as you sat down with them, as soon as you had a cup of tea together, you know, you could build a bit of a relationship. And they were, you know, without exception, just lovely people deep down. That's not excusing the things that they did or the things that they said. And I would pull them up on that. But actually, you know, people are people. We all bear our wounds, but we've all got great potential within us as well.
And you have gently reminded me that I haven't as yet properly introduced you to the listener. Who is Michael Manning? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Who is Michael Manning? Michael Manning is, I'm the 8th Manx Bard, which has been really one of my major focuses over the past few years. Although most of my adult life has been spent working with a former charity, it's now no longer a charity, called Gry, Manx Word for Love. And we sought to serve people who were homeless and in insecure accommodation on the island. So I've lived on the island since I was 5, so pretty much all my life. I've never lived and worked anywhere else. Got involved with Gry as an 18-year-old. I left school at 15 with no qualifications. Got involved down at the drop-in because I couldn't really say no and had some time on my hands, and ended up staying for the best part of 17-odd years. And that was my education. And so it's been an interesting journey. So I live in Douglas now and love the Isle of Man.
And Gry, well, let's talk a little bit about that. You have become well known, certainly in political circles, because of your work there. What does it take to be the sort of person that has to, you know, that's required to run a place like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one, because I got involved, you know, with people used to say to me, oh, you know, I couldn't do what you do, kind of thing. And I said, well, you know, I got involved as an 18-year-old with no experience, obviously, at 18, very much at all, but certainly no experience of mental health issues, alcohol and drug problems, addiction, that kind of thing. But I got involved as a Christian, and I'd grown up within Broadway, which was very supportive and was running the drop-in at the time. This was just before the charity was formed, Broadway Baptist Church in Douglas. And as a follower of Jesus, who spent lots of his time with people on the margins and people who were struggling, I thought I couldn't say no. And then you just get drawn into things. And I think, again, as a Christian, I think you get given the gifts you need to do the job you need to do in the place where you are. And it was a real privilege to be in a place where you're able to meet with people and build those relationships, help them at often a very vulnerable and difficult time of their lives. But a real privilege as well to go around the island, to speak to people, to, you know, people were incredibly generous on the island, and the whole wider community of the Isle of Man was very generous towards Gray. And that was a real privilege to be sort of a channel of that generosity, if you like, as well. And I think as well, it's about holding things lightly. I think when you are sort of an important figure within an organization, people can think, oh, that's like your whole life, but it's important that it's not, if that makes sense. And one of my hard early lessons at the drop-in was that it's fine to turn my phone off, it's fine to be unavailable, it's fine to say I need time away and with my family and everything else. And, you know, I'm no one's savior. And that, I think, allows you to hold things which are often difficult a bit more lightly. And that's what kind of sustains you in a long journey of traveling with people in kind of difficult circumstances.
And did you ever, prior to leaving school at 15, did you ever have an aspiration to be a poet? Was that something that had even crossed your mind?
Not particularly poetry, although I left to write. I've always loved writing, and I was very, I say to people, I used to enjoy actually sitting around the drop-in and say to people, if you've got one GCSE, and most of them had some kind of qualification, I said, well, there you go, you've got more qualifications than me, which was great, actually, because they were always amazed by that, thinking, oh, you must have got off to university and done all this kind of thing. And no, I left, I was very ill. I got very ill at the end of primary school and was ill for a number of years. So I missed a lot of my early secondary schooling. And then won a scholarship over to a boarding school in England. But I was only there for 6 months, started my GCSEs, missed the island, was struggling mentally in different ways as well. And left school wanting to write. And so wrote novels initially, none of which got published. But writing has always been a big part of my life. I'd written a little bit of poetry, but not a great deal. And it was only after I left Gray in 2022 that I kind of became more aware of the Manx Bard as a sort of cultural poetic role, and sort of wrote a couple of poems and put them in as sort of an interesting thing to do, really, and was quite amazed when I was selected. And since then, I've been very much focused on reading and writing lots of poetry, which has been a real blessing.
And poetry, I suppose, to many people, people think of learning poems, possibly learning poems off by heart at school, and the poems that perhaps didn't mean an awful lot to them and didn't say an awful lot to them. Poems can be all kinds of things, can't they? I mean, most people, certainly people who listen to Manx Radio, listen to music, they listen to songs, and songs effectively are poems, and some of the best songwriters in the world are really good poets. What do you see poetry as?
I see it as an attempt to speak words that are true and beautiful, and to do that as powerfully as possible. And I think my own practice as a poet is always an attempt at that, I think. And almost instantly I feel dissatisfied and I failed in doing that. You know, you're always on to the next, what's the next poem or the next way of doing it and tweaking things. But I think it's always an attempt to try and name something of the beauty and the radiance and the mystery that I think is at the heart of our lives. I think the world is amazing. We are amazing. And poetry is an attempt to express that.
Well, Gray, the book, has taken inspiration from Gray, the charity. Would you like to read us one of your poems just to start off with? I mean, there was one very powerful poem that you read out at the launch of the book, and that was about Knotfield. And for those who don't know, Knotfield, the former Isle of Man children's home, and it was, well, it had its scandals, basically.
Yeah, and certainly, and I think, one of my desires to within the book was to bear witness really to the community in which I live, and the guys and some of their stories, and that means being kind of honest about the bad stuff as well as the possibilities. So this is Not Field, In Memoriam SG. We sat in the chippy diner with our tea and let the silence brew and fill the space. He was a big man, gentle, with a kind and simple face that watched the free birds soar above the sea. At first we spoke of the promise of his new home, the comforts after sleeping in his car, the way his last employer had refused to let him stay, the way a friend's dog brought him solace when alone. He drank his tea. Then he told me of the long years of care, the way he was taken from his bedroom in the night, and when he ran away they would not believe his fright and took him back again, 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 to stare at the wall and hope and pray it would soon be over. The way they pimped the boys. The way he couldn't smell a certain deodorant without terror reaching through the decades. There was no escape. He was a big man, gentle, with a kind and open face. His hands were shaking, just like the little boy who spent his days trying to make himself small, the joy torn from his childhood, the wounds, the waste. One brother had walked into a shed and hung himself. The family was riven by the anger and the lies and the stubborn contempt of the powers that ignored the cries. Nothing left but the slow and sad erosion of his health. No anger in him, no violence and no rage, just a crushed kindness. No recrimination after all this time, an acceptance, not a liberation from the pain that bound his life into a cage. We sat in the chippy diner with our tea. The silence fell again. What can you say to such a revelation? Frail our bonds, the day broken. Below, the rocks are cleansed continually by sea.
Wow, that's such a powerful piece of writing and a powerful story as well.
Yeah, and I think I was sensitive about writing, and there's a number of the poems that are sort of portraits of some of the guests at Gry, and I was sensitive about, we live in a small community and I wanted to bear witness, but in an appropriate way. So I've left them anonymous with their initials. And then most of the people I write about are mostly people who have died. And we saw a lot of early death, you know, life expectancy in the 50s, really, from the guys that we saw, and a number, you know, significantly younger than that. But yeah, these are stories that are, you know, they're not happening in far-flung places. These are things that have happened within our lifetime in the Isle of Man, and you know, it's good to use whatever gifts I have to try and bear witness to that, and that's certainly been a motivation in the book.
And the book, as you say, it does I'm trying to think of the right words, it uses the memories you have of a number of people who went through Gry. That's a difficult thing, as you say, to do, because obviously the kinds of trauma and distress that people are dealing with when they end up in a homeless situation often are incredibly difficult stories, and stories perhaps that people don't really want told.
Yeah, and I think they're easy people to despise and easy people to ignore. You know, we're not talking about economically productive sections of the society particularly, although a number of them held various sorts of work over the years. I mean, fundamentally, I think one of the more powerful lessons about my time with Gry was a breaking down of the barriers between sort of us and them. You know, I got involved because I wanted to help, and certainly many people got involved because they wanted to help. But more profoundly, you know, I have got my own brokenness and difficulties, and I'm meeting with other people who have brokenness and difficulties. And really, that any hope that we have as a community together to bring more healing means healing for us all and for us both, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a great mutuality. I don't think we tried to very much break down the us and them, people used to come into the drop-in and have a look for, you know, 10, 15 minutes around the table and then say, well, who are the volunteers and who are the guests kind of thing. And I always loved that, you know, because that was exactly what we wanted to do, you know. And many of the guests spend their lives trying to navigate official things, you know, where they're dealing with people with all sorts of different authority and power, be that benefits or health or the police or the criminal justice system, whatever it might be. And to just meet people on a human level, I think is really powerful. Share food together, really powerful. And that's what builds relationships. And it's relationships that affect us both. It's not a one-way street. And that allows us, hopefully, to kind of just journey towards a more hopeful place, you know. And that can look like total transformation. And we saw a number of people who, you know, got much more stable and rebuilt relationships and returned to work and rebuilt their lives. And that's wonderful. But actually also, you know, success for us was just being there for very lonely, broken people at the end of their lives, you know, and people who were not going to get better, who were going to die, didn't have anybody else, but you were able to just be a presence for them at the end of their lives. And that was painful, but success as well. You know, it's just being there with people, regardless of what that journey looks like, that was important for us.
And Gry, the charity, did come to an end. That must have been a difficult time for you.
It was, yeah, and a bit of a surprise. I'd left in early 2022, and then thinking that Gry was on a particular sort of journey of development that would be ongoing, and then unfortunately throughout that year a number of relationships kind of fell apart, and the charity ended up closing in the autumn of 2022. I'm very grateful that the Baptist Church at Broadway decided to take on the work of the daytime drop-in particularly, which is ongoing under the name of Gry Ministries. So that's run directly by the Baptist Church. And they also now run some supported accommodation up in Ramsey, which is great. So there's still a presence there in Douglas during the day. So I'm sort of involved on the margins, if you like, and still involved in visiting a number of people who I had contact with and long relationships with through Gry, because a lot of my work was sort of pastoral visiting. But yeah, that was it was painful to see something that you've spent a long time with, you know, die in a certain way, even though a form of the work continues. But equally, you know, that was a real catalyst for, I wouldn't have applied to be the Manx Bard if I was still at Gry. I wouldn't have had the capacity or the time to do that. And that's been a real kind of blessing to just be involved, I suppose, in a different way in seeking to explore these problems and these lives and help them and shed some light on them in a different fashion, really.
Another of your poems then, Community Talk, I think it was. And, you know, I'm picking what I felt were highlights from your book launch, but you may have others. I don't know. I'm sure there are plenty. I haven't had a chance to read all the book as yet, but if we could hear Community Talk.
Yeah, so this is Community Talk, and this really comes from, as I mentioned, one of my roles as a spokesperson for a time with Gry was going around all sorts of little groups in the community, talking about homelessness, talking about the problems on the island, talking about the way that's often quite hidden. People were very generous. They wanted to donate and help and gave me time as well. And it was a really lovely to be able to see that. And yet that also made me feel a bit conflicted about sort of the model of charity and how that works and where's justice in that and other different ways of living and things like that. So it's those sorts of themes that are in this one. So this poem is called Community Talk. The kindness of these people is not doubted. They welcome me and laud me as a saint for working with the poor and homeless men, the hungry and their ragged desperation. They listen to my tales and show support with generosity and gifts of food and clothes that bear the smell and touch of home. They're kind and good. So how can I tell them of the great inadequacy of all our best efforts? We talk and trial and tinker. The need is visceral and too simple. A home, purpose and good relationships. How hard can these things be with all our wealth? We are one of the richest societies in all of human history, and yet we fail and fail again to find true life. There is a darkness at our very heart. Wherefore now the human, refractory? I am certain of fewer things, save this. There is no individual salvation. My healing is bound up with your healing. If there is hope, we will find it together and stumble on towards what is rapture, an ecstasy to yet transform the roots of what is and what could be. Is there a dream that can illuminate it all, go down right deep? The mystery is radiant. The bright constructions of the marginal, hammering out a sort of battered truth, a way to be and know right at the edge. But words cannot reckon reality. Hope is frail. It may not survive the wounds. It may just be a way of going on, pretending that we can somehow survive. These kind people are full of gratitude, thankful that there is someone who welcomes, who draws close to the humiliated, and it's not them. Now I must find the words, right words, if they exist. But everything must change, the way we live and work and love. If anyone claims to have answers, they are wrong. There is no path, only these signs of need and rage and flame obscuring tracks. How honest can we be? Come closer to the horror, and you find I do not love people. I do not even care for them. I am another fractured addict lost in pain and wondering where it went wrong. I am simply terrified of their need, unable to respond with more than tea and food, a sofa for a bed tonight. This is wholly inadequate, absurd. This is not what people really require, but all that we can do in such absence. Perhaps that's why it's easier to scorn the poor. They show up our chronic failure to share even the simplest things of life. They are kind, these people, and good, and true. I can't despise the gifts they want to give, even if we're condemned to play the roles assigned to us in bleak hegemony. Some prisons are not seen, and thus endure. And so the pearl remains unbought and buried, the golden treasure far beneath the ground and out of all our reach. Thus now I smile and tell my tales, and show my gratitude. The world remains unchanged, the guests alone, the spare rooms empty, and our hearts withered. None of us know. Not me, not these good folk, and not the homeless poor. We remain lost, strangers to each other, longing for love. I depart with praises ringing in my ears, bewildered in the tumult of my fears.
And that was the poem, Community Talk, yes, from your book, Gry. And in terms of the collection, I mean, I think it's pretty clear what has inspired you. It's the community in which you lived and worked and still live and work, I suppose. What inspired, or who inspired you as a writer in terms of other writers? Were there inspirations in that regard?
Oh, that's a good question. Other writers, I mean, I read voraciously and across genres, really. And I think in terms of poetry, been inspired by Gerard Manley Hopkins, inspired by W.H. Auden, particularly some of his sort of poems. And Hopkins's life and poetry were very powerful as well. But I think I've been very moved by some of Ursula Le Guin, who's a fantasy author, and she writes, I think, very powerfully and very movingly from a very human understanding, which has been moving recently. And I think one of the more powerful pieces of prose that I've read within the past decade or so, Cormac McCarthy, The Road, which is a very kind of apocalyptic, kind of post-apocalyptic one, which was incredibly bleak but very powerful and moving. So I'm a bit of a blackbird when it comes to you know, a forager and a scavenger when it comes to writing and reading, and that I'll try and read and write as much as I can in all sorts of places. And this particular collection, its subtitle is called Prophetic Utopian Poems, which is a bit of a mouthful for people. And that's borrowed from a liberation theologian who I also enjoy reading. And he's a man who spent his whole life living and working among the poor of El Salvador and looking what kind of peace and justice looks like there. That's John Sobrino, who wrote a collection of prophetic utopian essays, which I found very inspiring. And I think it's just shorthand that the prophetic is a sort of what's in front of us, what's the reality in front of us, you know, what's the world as it is, and the utopian is, well, what's the world as it should be or could be, what are the dreams we're going to dream that can, you know, make this better.
And I suppose the problem that we all have is that everyone has their own idea about what the world should be, and it is the general debate and discussion that ensues amongst hundreds, millions, billions of people that probably leaves us in the position we're in at the moment, where I don't know, we seem to be as a people, as an age, driven further and further apart. The peacemakers, the deal makers, the middle ground people seem to be despised in favour of the polarised and the extreme.
I think so, and I think one of the things that I think has, and again, one of the experiences I had through the guides was just encouraged to ask deeper questions, really, and why are the guests turning up like this at the drop-in? You know, what are their stories? What's the history? And as soon as you get beyond that, you get beyond an individual story that often carries its own hopes, fears, pains, and responsibilities as well. But you get into the realm of bigger powers, you know, social and economic and cultural powers. And I think you know, we live in an age where those powers do seek, I think, to divide us and do seek to hive us off as individuals, and individualism, and the angrier and more sort of outrageous your voice is, the more likely you are to get heard. But I think it's most people want the world to be a kinder, nicer, better place. And we seem somewhere to have lost the sort of the faith that it can be like that, you know, and that most of the powers that we talk about are there to be our servants rather than our masters. You know, the economy is a mix of our social choices together. It's not a force of nature that we need to sort of kowtow to and appease in some way. And I think that sense of, as a poet, you know, that I would hope to bring a sense of just utopian possibility and imagination. And I'm a simple man at heart with very simple questions. Why can't the world be better? Why can't children be fed properly? Why can't we have proper housing for everybody? Why can't we share the things more? Why do people need tons and tons of wealth and some people have got nothing? Just dead simple questions. And I think, you know, why not ask them and try and work out solutions?
and many of those questions, of course, people would have overwhelmingly the same response to. I mean, nobody in the world, I can't imagine there'd be anyone in the world that would think it's right that any child should go hungry, for example. And yet, despite all the generations of politicians, of leaders, of political thinkers, theological thinkers, we still seem to be in the position that we're in.
And I think it's, I mean, I'm not a politician, and in that sense you've got the freedom of, you're not trying to sort of win anyone's approval kind of thing, but I think you know, it's from a my sort of utopian vision is very much informed by my faith as well, and I think part of that, and part of my experience, I think, building relationships with the guys is realizing what's rich in life is not material goods, and it's not sort of working all the hours to get the mortgage and the pension and everything else. It's relationships and it's people, and I think I'm very happy to settle for having materially less but actually having a far richer life. And I think that is potential. I'm not sure whether that should be an unpopular message. Maybe it is, because we've been so kind of hooked on acquisition for the past couple of generations, on the island particularly, but in the Western culture more generally as well, and the sense of individualism, and that we need to sort of get more and protect ourselves against, you know, people out there who may have less and want their hands on our stuff kind of thing. And I just think that's mostly false. I just think it's false.
Yes, I'm going to ask you to choose a poem of your own choice, because I've picked two, and I've also picked the one that we're going to finish with. So, I mean, if you can, you could have a think of one. But yes, the gyms are the thing that affects me. You know, I think of all the generations up until possibly this last generation of people who used to do a very full day and often very manual sort of hard work. And you know, the whole the concept of paying to go and do even more hard work when you'd finished a day's work is quite a bizarre one. And it's possible, you know, well, it's a construct of the world that we've created for ourselves. And again, you know, one of the reasons many people need wealth is so that they can afford to pay for the specialist courses that they go on, the yoga retreats, the special mental health therapy apps that they can get on their phones, all these sorts of things to help them live in this quite crazy world that we've created. It is a strange world, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's just I just think there's a satisfaction often to be found in things that are much more simple. And I'm not hugely nostalgic about returning to a time of spuds and herring and everyone doing manual labour. I'm clear-eyed about the difficulties of subsistence living. We don't want, you know, to return to that as a society. But actually, you know, we have massive wealth as a society, you know, richer than beyond the wildest dreams of most of our forebears. And so there should be no question about people being in need. I just don't understand why that's not just seems obvious to me, you know. I mean, economists might look at me and think, well, it's a bit more complicated than that. But actually, again, the economy is there to serve people. You know, it's not, people aren't there to serve the economy. We're not all sort of just trying to get a bit more growth into the machine kind of thing. It's there to make our lives richer and more fulfilling for all of us. And that goes for all of us, no matter what our capacities are, no matter how much we can contribute or not. You know, we're valued just as people. And I think that's, again, a lesson from the drop-in, was that people are just really precious no matter who they are, no matter what they bring. And everyone brings some kind of gift, even if it's just the gift of their presence. And that's, you know, really important that people hear that people know that, and that we have a culture that is increasingly built around those values rather than, you know, material acquisition and power.
Have you managed to pick another?
I've got one here, which is called Work Days. And this is from one of the, talking about purpose, actually, in people's lives. You know, we all need purpose of some sort. And one of the joys that we had with the guys was that we used to go out a couple of days a week, sometimes just a day a week, to go out on what we called work days, where we'd all pitch into the battered old minibus and we'd go off, and we had an allotment for a few years, and we used to dig up things. But we also used to go and do basic jobs, chopping down things for people and basic stuff like that. And the guys used to love that. They used to love doing something. They used to love being out of Douglas. They used to work really hard, you know, really enjoyed it. We'd all just have a good laugh, drink lots of tea. And this is a reflection on that, I suppose. This is called Work Days. Silby Valley in the sun sings jubilation. The blue sky grazed by the great green hills. And down here, the soft ribbon of the river unfurling as we work. We cut the gorse with handsaws, drag the branches together, set the fire. How can it all be burned away? The struggle and the streets and the blank hunger of addiction and the charcoal-charred relationships. We cut the gorse at the roots, drag the branches together, feed the fire. Andy Mack in jovial charisma. The wizard sat on a stump smoking a rollie. Shared food and flasks of sweet tea, the fire burning, sparks of how it could or should or will or would be.
Yes, that's again a wonderful piece of writing. And I suppose that's what that must. I mean, I don't write myself. I write pithy promos for these programs, but beyond that, I haven't written much over the years. But I imagine the great thing about being a writer is you're only really limited by your imagination.
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's like any gifts, and I suspect this is the same for people with any kind of gifts, really. In that, you take it a bit for granted. You know, I've spent my whole life, that as far back as I can remember, I've loved words, loved reading, loved immersing myself in it. So I don't think, you'd never think of myself, I certainly don't think of myself as someone with, you know, huge skills in writing or anything like that. You're just trying to bring some expression, and often it's working through emotions and thoughts and questions and problems and challenges that I've got. But I think one of the joys of being the bard in a slightly more public-facing role, I suppose, and looking what poetry can do for us as a community, has been seeing the power of words, you know, and the power of words to move people, to inspire people, to challenge people, and the emotions that you can bring. And that's just a real privilege. I mean, it's just a real grace. And I very much see it as a gift. And I've been keen to kind of try and use that as a gift to the community and in bearing witness to this time and place. But yeah, it's just an absolute privilege.
And on the subject of gift, the book, Gray, is not for sale.
It's not for sale, thankfully, yeah. And I'm extraordinarily happy that you won't find it on Amazon for lots of different reasons. I mean, I'm really grateful to Culture Vanin for supporting the publication of Gray, and that's enabled me to have great freedom as an author in about how I distribute it. So the book is available for free. It was free at the launch concert, and it's free at the Bridge Bookshop, the Book Company, and the Church's Bookshop in Douglas. There are also copies in all the public libraries. And again, that was with a sense of both, I've received poetry really in the gift of poetry as a gift to me, and I'd like to share that freely like any gift, and sort of embody a bit of the economy of grace. But also, when you're writing about you know, people with materially not a lot, you don't want to be charging, you know, 10 quid for the book kind of thing before you read poems about poverty. And so there's an accessibility thing that has been important to me as well, in that I want this to be a book that is available and freely available to anyone who wants to read it. And really, I'm very grateful to anybody who does. So that's been the motivation behind that.
And as far as your bardic activity is concerned, I mean, you are presumably part of the bardic team that organises the Manx Bard competition.
Yes, I am, and that's been a real joy, and it's been a joy seeing the diversity that we have within the sort of the bardic college, if you like. I think we're Bradley at the moment is our 11th Manx Bard, and we've got some wonderful youth bards as well. And it's just been a joy. It's been a joy to have a bit more time and space to be able to be involved with the poetic community on the island. And that's been an inspiration and a great encouragement to me. Many of the wonderful poets of the island have been incredibly generous to me as a poet. And I've been, hugely, hugely grateful for that.
What would you give as advice to someone, maybe someone such as myself who writes pithy promos but hasn't got past that, and maybe has things that they want to say? How would you go about starting in relation to writing poetry?
I think the first thing I'd do would be to read as much as possible. And I think, because I think that just helps. It gets stuff. It sort of like feeds the unconscious reservoir, if you like, the soil from which, you know, your own stuff can grow. And so I think to, you know, any good writer of poetry or of any other sort has to be a voracious reader as much as possible. I mean, and I've tried to read eclectically, as widely as possible. Some stuff I read, I don't think that's, well, don't really like that. But then it's in the reading that you realise what you do and don't like. And then I think it's just trying to be honest, trying to bring an honesty of what you're trying to say and a clarity to it, and practice that, get it down on the page and give it a go.
And Gray is your, well, it's your only published collection. Would you like to say that it is your first published collection?
Well, that would be a lovely thing. Having you know, not long finished it, I'm taking a bit of a breath. I mean, certainly, I'm always full of ideas and things that I want to write about, and I don't necessarily feel I'm got the skills to address what I'd want to address, but certainly there's a lot more poems to write out there. And I was chatting actually relatively recently with another poet, and we were reflecting on you know, the poetic practice, if you like. And I said, well, it's kind of like a really necessary, you're trying to bring words that will bear witness to the reality of whatever situation you're writing about. You're doing your best to be as honest about that as possible. And it's almost like you're always going to fail at that, because reality is always more complicated and more wondrous and more mysterious than any words of mine can ever plumb the depths of. But it's a really necessary failure to go through. And when you've done that and you've done your best to put an expression to it and bear some witness, then you pick yourself up and you try again on a different poem and a different theme and a different image. And I think it's okay to keep on trying. And certainly as a poet, I hope to keep on trying to bear witness to what I see and what I hope for.
And I don't know, is it 60, 70 poems in the book, something like that?
There's 93.
Oh, gosh. So 93 poems in the book. How many aren't in the book?
A good selection. This isn't sort of a collected works by any means. This was quite a tightly focused collection of poems, focused on Gray and the themes and issues and ideas arising from my experiences there. There's a good scutch still that I've written that aren't published and aren't in the book. I hope there's more to come as well.
And as far as your appearances as a bard, how do you go about that? I mean, you just, if someone asks you, you go out and recite a poem?
Pretty much. I mean, I don't like saying no to people, and particularly when they're kind enough to invite you things. And there's always, I mean, certainly when you're the current bard, you'll often get asked to write poems about certain specific themes or groups. You know, I was, the Manx Wildlife Trust had their 50th celebrations while I was the current bard, and so they asked me to write a poem for their anniversary. And that's a real challenge, to write about things that you wouldn't find yourself naturally writing about, but again a huge privilege. And I think part of the bardic role is, I mean, I love reading poetry, but I love reciting poetry as well. And I think there's a power to the recital of things. There's a power to being in a room just with people together and sharing those words together. And I think there's actually a power of, I find it really powerful when poets read their own work. I think there's a spirit, I think, that comes with that they bring as an author of a work. And so I really enjoy being out and about in the community reciting poetry, and I'm usually happy to recite anything wherever I'm invited.
And one of the things that you do, which I particularly enjoy, is not every poem, but some poems you really do recite them. You don't read them. You've learned them. You've memorized them. Mm-hmm. And there's something quite powerful about speaking words in that way, which allows you a better connection with the people who are listening, because you can have eye contact and you can have expression rather than the expression of trying to make sure you've got to the right sentence as you're reading.
I think so, and that's part of a sort of a different, you know, a different public speaking kind of role, really. And I like to, when I have a chance to, and it takes time obviously, but I like to try and memorize poems that I'm going to recite. I have had one absolute disaster when I've stood up and started to recite something and my mind's gone absolutely blank, and that was very embarrassing. And that was with a load of other bards as well, which is even more embarrassing. But that hasn't, you know, totally deterred me. It's probably good for my humility. I do try to recite from memory when I can. And I do think it does bring learning something by heart ingrains it in you, which means you can find the sort of stresses and rhythms that you want to get as a poet in a spoken piece of poetry. I think it lends its own kind of power to the recital as well. So when I have the chance, I try to.
One of the things that fills me with the most dread, being married to one of the Manx bards, is what did you get from that poem? That question.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, one of the things about poems is lots of people listen to a poem and interpret it in ways, I suppose, that tie in with their own life experiences.
Absolutely. And I think one of the joys and the powers of poetry is that, you know, you and I and anybody else can come to a poem and read it. And because of that, where we're reading it, our own histories, our own experience, where we are in that time and place, it'll say something different to us. And I think great poetry has the potential and the power to speak to us in a number of different contexts, you know. And I've been very inspired by the ancient poetry of the Bible, you know, which is written in a totally different context, you know, thousands of years ago in some cases, with a totally different worldview. And yet those words in translation to English in the 21st century still have a power to speak to me and to move me and to inspire me. And I think great poetry is cross-cultural, cross-language, cross-history, you know, can speak to us, and we can draw different things from it at different times, and that's the power of words.
And we're kind of winding ourselves up to the final poem now. Tell us a bit about that poem.
Yeah, so this poem was written... it was written as an Easter poem, actually, and particularly has got themes of new creation in it. So it kind of takes the 7 days of creation from Genesis and reworks them a little bit. And it's a very much a hopeful poem, and it's very much it's probably as close as I've come to a poetic manifesto, I suppose. I mean, my hope as a Christian is by no means a sort of a disembodied kind of afterlife. I find the Christian hope very rooted in the everyday and rooted in our social and political realities, and I think those are really important, and they need to be transformed by kindness and hope and grace, and so that's what fills me with hope. But also I think is what I'm trying to bring across in the poem, and it also speaks, I think, of a sense of there's always something better yet to come. You know, our best efforts are fantastic, but there's going to be some good ones still to come still.
And the name of the poem?
The name of the poem is The New Songs.
And certainly it's very inspiring. Anyone who hasn't heard you recite this, and it's not quite the same over the radio because we can't see your smile, which is infectious, I think, as you are. Your hopeful smile, the hope in your eyes when you recite this poem. It's a tremendous thing.
Well, that's very kind of you, Phil. I mean, and certainly it's just I'm just trying to be as honest as I can about the things that I hope for, about the kind of transformations I want to see. And I think those are transformations that involve all of us. You know, my hope is not just for me on my own. It's a hope for us together. And I, you know, I really hope that the poetry speaks to that communal sense of purpose and vision.
Well, we will hear the poem as we approach the end of the programme now. Michael Manning, thank you very much for joining us on Perspective, and I hope that a few of the more cynical political listeners might just be inspired to be a bit more positive.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Phil. It's always wonderful to come and talk with you. Thank you for your kindness. This is The New Songs. I want to sing the new songs. The songs that will make people well, not just well enough, not just lame and limping, scoured and rough. The song to sweep through a hospital ward and cast Zimmer frames aside. Crutches fall, frail bodies rise, exultant now and glorified. The songs of light. I want to sing the new songs. The songs that will make people whole and healed and good. No pinched and narrow survival, but a strengthening passion in the blood. The song to make the children's faces shine in joyous recognition. Yes, this world is fine. The songs of sky and heaven. I want to sing the new songs. The songs that will surge through every home and make it smile. Bitter words and wounds softened as kindness comes to reconcile. The song to set the table racing, rafters high with feasting, facing one another with a truth that broadens, breaks, embracing. Vast songs of earth and ocean, growing trees. I want to sing the new songs, the songs to unlock the grim prison's doors, call out the startled inmates, finding all our flaws now eased. Harsh tongues stilled, eyes new rinsed, to behold a laughing land, no longer grey, enclosed and dim, but gold, the songs celestial. I want to sing the new songs, the songs that cross the bleak borders, raise a fence, the guards awestruck by something more immense, they unbar the gates and beckon invitation as pilgrim masses ebb and flow. At last, a liberation, the songs of wing and waves. I want to sing the new songs. The songs rejoicing in a rich abundance, partaking of a sustaining wealth where all is shared, gregarious, unmaking all that's crooked, mean, a torrent of tender jubilee, brimful of glad justice and tenacious solidarity. The songs of all things living. I want to sing the new songs. Don't tell me of the stern and petty ways of a weary world. Let me take the gun. Let's walk amazed and reforge all our weapons into better tools of peace. To all the hated knots within, without, Christ's sweet release, the songs of rest. I want to sing the new songs, the songs that mark our long labour to the light, the songs to bring fresh beauty into sight, the songs to make your life and mine a bright delight, the songs that source and end in silence, satisfied. Oh, I want to sing the new songs. Together, will we sing? Go out in a gorgeous new creation, adventuring? It's not too late. Come now, rise and sing. New words await.
Well, Michael Manning wants to sing some new songs of hope and positivity. Will anyone listen? Let's hope so.